Welcome to this presentation of Human Life International. The following talk, entitled Our Lady of Guadalupe, Model for Life, was given by Mrs. Patricia Pitkiss Bainbridge at the 5th Annual Indiana Women's Catholic Conference, which took place on March 15, 2008, in Indianapolis, Indiana. HLI's contact information will be given at the end of this program. So let's proceed to our feature presentation.
Like many other converts, I simply had no appreciation for the significance of Mary's role in salvation. Yes, I knew she gave birth to Jesus. That was pretty obvious. We heard that once a year at Christmas. But I totally missed the importance of the Blessed Mother. I remember once speaking at the Florida Respect Life Conference. It was in 1995, just before my husband and I had decided to become Catholic, and they had this huge image of the Blessed Mother on display. I now know that it was that image of Our Lady of Guadalupe, but at the time, I only knew it was the Virgin Mary. I distinctly remember asking the conference people if they could hide her, as I had invited some of my evangelical friends to my talk. And I knew if they saw this image, they would freak out. And at that time, I didn't know how to explain her myself. Fortunately, they did not honor my request. My friends didn't show, and God forgave me. I did have dinner with those friends, however, that evening, and I told them that my husband and I were converting to the Catholic Church. I wish you could have seen the expression on their face. To say they were shocked would be an understatement. They tried their best to convince me that we were making a huge mistake, but fortunately they failed. Thank you. Because I realized, unlike some so-called cafeteria Catholics today, that one must actually believe what the church teaches, I accepted the teachings on Mary, but I really didn't get it until one day while reading scripture, Luke 1:42 and Luke 1:48 really popped out at me. You know the scripture where Elizabeth exclaims, "Blessed are you among women," and Mary in her Magnificat saying, "For behold, henceforth all generations will call me blessed." Bingo, there it was. How could anyone question the importance of Mary in salvation history when she is blessed among women? And all, not some, not one, not two, but all generations will call her blessed? Blessed. That was huge. She was the dwelling place of the Most High. I finally got it. Didn't take me too long. Now I was beginning to look at Holy Scripture's treatment of Mary, and although there aren't a lot of specific references, the ones that are there are perfectly clear. Mary is referred to as the mother of Jesus no less than 8 times in the New Testament. In John's Gospel, we read, "When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing near, he said to his mother, 'Woman, behold your son.' Then he said to the disciple, 'Behold your mother.' And from that hour, the disciple took her to his own home." End of quote. Jesus was instructing us that Mary indeed is our spiritual mother. Slowly but surely, I also began to see that the woman described in Revelation 12 was indeed our Blessed Mother. And I quote from Revelation, "And a great portent appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was with child, and she cried out in her pangs of birth in anguish for delivery." As evangelicals, we had been taught that the woman in Revelation was a symbol of the birth of the church, but now that really didn't make sense to me. And then I thought seriously about Mary carrying and protecting Christ during her pregnancy. He received everything he needed and was totally dependent on her for 9 months. God actually took human form in the womb of Mary. She was no ordinary woman. She was indeed blessed among all women. Christ came to us through Mary. As St. Alfonso de Liguori wrote, quote, "This divine mother is infinitely inferior to God, but immensely superior to all creatures. And it is impossible to find a son more noble than Jesus, so it is also impossible to find a mother more noble than Mary." My appreciation of our Holy Mother finally began to take hold. Ah, but the story doesn't end here. Part of my internal struggle was not over. I still didn't know what to think about the reported apparitions of Mary. I found in the Catechism, it was very clear that private revelation does not belong to the deposit of faith, so Catholics are not bound to accept such apparitions. But was it possible that Our Lady actually appeared at various times during history? And if she did, what was the significance of such apparitions? Enter our favorite new television station back in 1995, EWTN. One Saturday afternoon, as I was watching EWTN, lo and behold, there appeared on my screen a special on the apparition and image of Our Lady of Guadalupe. To say I was fascinated would be an understatement. I was focused like a laser beam on what I was seeing and what I was hearing. I can't tell you the name of this special, but what I do remember is that after paying close attention, I came to understand that our Blessed Mother did indeed appear to Juan Diego in Mexico and that her apparition was very significant. I remember being fascinated by the scientists who were interviewed and could offer no explanation as to why Juan Diego's tilma, the poncho-like garment where the image of Our Lady miraculously appeared and remained, had not disintegrated as would be expected. There were a number of other things about the image that could not be explained, and that too fascinated me. After seeing the program, rereading scripture, and recognizing the honor given to Our Lady of Guadalupe by many popes, I had no doubt about the authenticity of Our Lady of Guadalupe's apparitions or Juan Diego's tilma. Keep in mind, I'm not easily convinced about a lot of things. Okay, it takes a lot to convince me. But I was convinced. I did believe in miracles, and I do believe in miracles, and I believe that Mary's apparition in Mexico is a miracle. And then, lo and behold, I discovered that Our Lady of Guadalupe was the unofficial but nevertheless important patroness of the unborn. In all my years of involvement in the pro-life movement, and they have been many, I had seen the image that I now know as Our Lady of Guadalupe, but I had no idea of her significance. Mary is described in the Catechism as the supreme model of this faith and as the model of holiness. And Mary, especially as Our Lady of Guadalupe, is our model for life. Of all of the approved images of our Blessed Mother, Our Lady of Guadalupe is the only one that is with child, thus emphasizing her motherly role for the preborn. Mary's appearances in Mexico were the first recorded and widely celebrated of her apparitions in modern history, while there are seven other major trustworthy apparitions of the Blessed Virgin Mary that have been recorded and approved. Our Lady of Guadalupe was the first. I was really surprised by that. I had no idea. All others, including Our Lady of the Miraculous Medal, Lourdes, Fatima, occurred hundreds of years after our Blessed Mother appeared in Mexico. Before Our Lady's appearance, Mexican society had undergone huge changes after Spain conquered Mexico in 1521. Native Mexicans were the Aztec Indians, who now had not only lost the war, but they lost their culture. When the Spanish invaders took over, everything changed for them, and they were devastated. There were so many differences between the Spaniards and the Aztecs, but the largest difference was about religion. Before the Spaniards arrived, Mexican culture had been formed by the Aztecs. They were very religious people, but they were pagan. Their main Aztec god was a serpent, sort of makes one think of the serpent in the garden in Genesis, the very form that Satan took. Human sacrifice was actually required by law. Every town that had a temple, and that was close to 400 towns, were required by law to make human sacrifice. Estimates of how many sacrifices were carried out each year vary from a low of 25,000 to a high of over 50,000. Father William Sanders reports that in 1487, an 89-year-old Aztec ruler dedicated the new temple, Pyramid of the Sun, in the center of what would become Mexico City. Over a period of 4 days, keep this in mind, we're talking 4 days and 40 nights, more than 80,000 men were sacrificed. That's 20,000 each day. These sacrifices, which were carried out on altars that were positioned on the top of temple pyramids, way, way up at the top of these pyramids, they had altars. They were extremely gruesome sacrifices. The Aztec priests would actually cut beating hearts out of the victims, and then they would hold the beating hearts up for all to see. Their bodies would then be tossed down the hundreds of steps that led up to the altar. As you can imagine, the pyramids were covered in blood. The hair on the priests' heads were continually matted with blood, and you can only imagine the stench, sort of like what goes on at some abortion mills in our country when they throw the babies out in the dumpsters. One of the Aztec gods who resided in a temple on a hill called Tepeyac was the goddess of motherhood. That sounds sort of good, doesn't it? No, it's not. Tens of thousands of Indians were sacrificed at her shrine. As terrible as that was, and it was, let us never forget that our nation's attitude about abortion is also depraved. In this country, abortion is perfectly legal at any time during pregnancy for little or no reason, and close to 4,000 tiny humans are killed every day. And if that's not bad enough, just this week, there was a new study, a very good study, with bad news, but a very good study, released this week that reports that, and I'm quoting, "The Roman Catholic Church consistently teaches that sex before marriage, abortion, pornography, and homosexual activity are sins. Yet as many as half of all practicing Catholics do not personally define each of these as sinful," end quote. It is so diabolical that many Catholics, including some in religious orders and a few priests, even call themselves today pro-choice. Others, calling themselves pro-life, stand idly by and do nothing. People from both groups cast votes for politicians who advocate child sacrifice through abortion and see nothing wrong with it, choosing to be loyal to their political party instead of loyal to the church. As Brother Michael of the Slaves of the Immaculate Heart of Mary writes, quote, "In their frenzied derangement, the Aztecs thought that since men were created by the blood of the gods, then they must return that blood or the gods would die. At least they had a reason for their insanity," says Brother Michael. Today, when our Christian civilization is allowing hooded priests in white doctor's robes to murder 1.5 helpless infants every year for no other reason than a diabolical selfishness that prefers nice cars and fashionable clothes to children, one wonders which society is the more corrupt, end quote. Although Cortez outlawed the human sacrifices in 1520, cleansed the pyramids, and erected new altars and had mass on the top of some of the pyramids, there is evidence that the sacrifices continued in secret, often resulting in the killing of many children. There may be a law, there may have been a law forbidding such practices, but the hearts of the people weren't converted yet. The sacrifices were so deeply embedded in their culture that such abominations could not just be stopped because some foreign conqueror outlawed them. They merely took place under the cover of darkness. The Indians needed a conversion of heart before they could cease the sacrificial killings. Just because the Spaniards won the war did not mean that the Aztecs suddenly embraced their beliefs and the culture of the Spaniards. Even for those who were baptized, they did not fully accept the faith of their conquerors because many of the Spaniards sadly lived immoral lives, engaged in corruption, and actually abused the Indians themselves. As a result, the Indians were very reticent to accept Christianity, engaged in uprisings when the missionaries tried to convert them. They were so despondent, in fact, that when they were told their gods were not real, they didn't feel like going on with life. As a result, the missionaries were very discouraged, and the first bishop of Mexico, Juan de Zumárraga, prayed for help. He prayed and he prayed, and help he got. God sent help in the form of our Blessed Mother to evangelize the Americas, beginning in the exact geographical center of North and South America, that city which is now called Mexico City. The miracle of Our Lady of Guadalupe began on Saturday, December 9th, 1532, the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, when Juan Diego, a 57-year-old widower and a convert, just like me, I'm not comparing myself to Juan Diego, don't get me wrong here, he was on his way to Mass and catechism class. As he passed by Tepeyac Hill, the former residence of that pagan goddess of motherhood, he heard beautiful music and then the voice of a woman calling out to him by name. He listens, and the woman tells him that she is the Blessed Virgin Mary. And respecting the authority of the church, she asks him to take a message from her to the bishop, requesting him to build a church on the very same hill that so many sacrifices had seen. Our Blessed Mother knew that many would be coming to the faith, and she wanted a church built where the people could come and worship her son and where she could help them. Juan Diego, being a very humble man, respectfully protested, saying, "I'm not the right person. Send someone more worthy, better educated, and someone younger." She responded patiently, "I have many children and many messengers, but I have chosen you. You are my littlest son. I want you to go." Juan was obedient. He met with the bishop and told him of the Blessed Virgin's request. But after telling the bishop what the Blessed Mother told him to say, Juan becomes very discouraged because the bishop didn't believe him. He heads home and sees the Blessed Mother again. She tells him to go back to the bishop again on the following day to repeat the request. Juan visits the bishop again, and the bishop tells him he needs a sign in order to believe that the message is truly from the Blessed Virgin Mary. When Juan returns to see the Blessed Virgin Mary, she says, "My little son, am I not your mother? Do not fear. The bishop shall have his sign. Come back to this place tomorrow. Only peace, my son." On his way home, Juan learns that his uncle is near death. Due to his uncle's worsening health, Juan Diego misses his appointment with Our Lady that was scheduled for Monday, December 11th. On December 12th, Juan rushes to find a priest for his dying uncle. So not to be diverted from his mission, he avoids seeing the Blessed Virgin Mary by going on the other side of the hill. But just as we can't hide from God, Juan Diego could not hide from Our Lady. She comes down the hill and meets him once again. Now he's a little concerned, so he explains why he missed their appointment. And she tells him, "Your uncle will not die of this sickness. Be assured, he is healthy." She then tells him to go to the top of the hill and gather the flowers that he will find there. When he gets to the top of the hill, he finds Castilian roses growing in the rocky soil. And keep in mind, this was the winter season. Roses, flowers, they don't grow in the winter. But he found them, and he cut them. He brought them down to her, and after she arranged the flowers in his toma, she tells him to take the roses in his toma to the bishop again as a sign. Well, he was met with many obstacles, just like some of us trying to get into the church. But Juan finally sees the bishop. Standing in front of the bishop and other witnesses, Juan Diego opened his toma, and the roses fell to the floor. And we think that's pretty miraculous. But then, the beautiful image of the Blessed Virgin Mary appeared on Juan Diego's toma. All present in that room, including the bishop, fell to their knees. This is the image that we know as the image of Our Lady of Guadalupe, and it still can be seen some 476 years later in the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mexico City. With Mary revealing herself as Our Lady of Guadalupe, she offered hope to a culture and people who were suffering greatly. She came to bring them the good news of Christ and his church. Interestingly, this was about 14 years after Martin Luther's little soiree, shall we say, and the beginning of the Reformation in Europe. As a result, many were leaving the church in Europe, but many would be coming to the church in Mexico. This was also the same time period when King Henry VIII took 5 million people from the church by an act of supremacy, thus making himself the head of the church in England. In effect, the Blessed Virgin Mary anticipated and preempted the king's pride and disobedience. By the time Henry VIII set himself up as head of the church in England, Mary had converted at least 5 million to her son's church in Mexico. Well, word about the apparitions, as you can imagine, and the miraculous image spread quickly and widely, and the Aztecs came in huge numbers to view this image. As much as the miracle of the tilma may move us, and it does, and it should, the greatest effect of her apparitions was the conversion of the Aztecs. Because of Aztec symbolism in the image, they understood the significance of what was on that tilma. And as a result, in the next 10 years, over 9 million Aztecs were baptized into Christ. With the widespread conversion to Christ came transformation of society. Now, I'm going to be talking about the image and its symbolism, and I realize you can't see all of that symbolism. So what I do is invite you at some time to find the image that's being shown on the screen, which is considered a replica of the image in Mexico. Stand in front of it, kneel in front of it, and really look at it. This won't be hard. You'll remember what I'm telling you, and I think you will see things that you've never seen before. Mary had been sent by God from heaven for a most important mission, and it has been said that every detail of her image is symbolic, sending a very strong message to the Aztecs that would bring them to Christ and his church. This symbolism was crucial for the conversion of Mexico, as there were over 100 indigenous languages spoken by the natives, and they could not read. Today, we have the catechism. We can read that, or we can read books about the apparition. But at that time, they couldn't do that. If you do an internet search for images of Our Lady of Guadalupe, one popular search engine will direct you to 30,200. That's a lot of images. While keeping in mind there are a number of variations of the image in those 30,200, the image you see here is a digital replication of the one housed in Mexico City. Defying the physical laws of nature, Juan Diego's tilma with the image of Our Lady of Guadalupe remains intact some 476 years after it miraculously appeared. The tilma was hand-woven from cactus fibers. And again, by all laws of nature, it should have disintegrated within 30 or 40 years. And yet, even today, it shows no sign of deterioration. Beginning in 1929, the church approved of a number of scientific studies on the tilma that reveal that much of the image is inexplicable. Some of the highlights of those studies indicate that the color of the image was not from animal, vegetable, or mineral sources, and that there is something very unusual about how the color changes with distance from the image. Some of the most fascinating scientific studies about the image have been with Mary's eyes. Zenit reported in July of 2002 that scientist Jose Aste Tansman examined the image and found 12 figures reflected in Our Lady of Guadalupe's eyes. When asked if these figures could be the work of humans, Aste told Zenit no for three reasons. In the first place, they are not visible to the human eye. So no matter how long you look at it or I look at it, we won't see them unless we have a huge magnifying glass. Except for one, and that is of the Spaniard, which is the largest. Nobody could have painted such tiny silhouettes. In the second place, he said, the origin of the pigments of these figures is unknown. And the same is true of the Virgin's image. It is not painted, and no one yet knows how it was stamped on Juan Diego's tilma. The three figures are reproduced in both eyes. What artist would do that, he said. Moreover, their size varies from one eye to the other, according to how close the personage was to the Virgin's left or right eye. Based on historical evidence, Aste identified Juan Diego and the bishop, among other people. NASA scientists, as well as many others, have examined the image and concluded that much of it is indeed inexplicable, which is why there is a huge difference between paintings representing apparitions and the true miracle of the actual portrait of Our Lady of Guadalupe on Juan Diego's tilma. I must tell you, however, and I hope this doesn't shock anybody, but not all recognized authorities on the image agree about certain findings. There are varying interpretations and misunderstandings about the image, but these in no way should distract us from the true miracle that took place. That being said, we need to be as accurate as we can be in our assessments. In 1979, Dr. Philip Callahan, a devout Catholic and a biophysicist with an expertise in infrared photography, was granted permission to examine the image. He was also a painter. His findings included the fact that, and I'm quoting here, the original figure, including the rose robe, the blue mantle, the hands, and the face, are inexplicable. He said that there was no way to explain either the kind of color, luminosity, and brightness of the pigments over the centuries, and that no explanation of the portrait is possible by infrared techniques. He believes, however, that many details were added by human hands, probably during the 17th century. Brother Thomas Mary Sennett, however, says that extensive human additions to the tilma might be true, but he suspects that Callahan is overdoing it. He supports his assertion by claiming that these additions could not have been made in the 17th century, because just 39 years after the apparition, there was a copy of the image which is now enshrined in Italy, and this copy is identical to the original image, which means that any additions had to have been made well before 1570. Brother Sennett concludes that perhaps additions could have been made on the top of the miraculous colors, but he says, being unvarnished, they are now beginning to flake off. He suspects that all additions were made almost immediately by Indian artists to enhance the pictogram nature of the image. Again, I repeat, in no way do these disagreements or additions detract from the authenticity of the miraculous portions of the image. The important fact is that the overall image that you see from where you are sitting meant life to the Aztecs. And that is what we need to focus on today. The image was full of symbolism, and that provided a way for the illiterate Indians to understand the truth about the one true God. Mary's face is mestizo, meaning it's of mixed race, John Paul II said that by being mestizo, her face expresses her spiritual motherhood, which embraces all Mexicans. Although she is dressed like a woman from the Holy Land, many details of her dress spoke to the Mexicans. Just as the woman of Revelation 12, Mary came standing on the moon, surrounded by the rays of the sun, clothed with stars and with an angel at her feet. The moon, sun, and stars were some of the pagan gods of the Aztecs. And now these gods were presented with Mary being more prominent than they. She is standing in front of the sun, thus signifying that she is greater than their pagan gods. In the Aztec language, the word Mexico meant in the center of the moon, exactly where Mary is standing. By standing on the crescent moon, which represented another pagan god of night and darkness, Mary again sends a message that she is more powerful than their gods. By standing on the moon, she represents divine triumph over evil. And yet, because her head is tilted to the right, she sends the message of humility, that she is not a goddess. There is one greater than she. Also, Aztec gods and goddesses always looked straight ahead, and they had very stern eyes that were wide open. They would never appear with soft, inviting eyes and a soft, inviting body posture. To the Aztecs, Mary's hands were positioned in a sign of a greeting or as offering something to them. To the Spaniards, of course, and to us, her hands are in a gesture of prayer. The angel under Mary's feet signifies that she is a heavenly being. While the Indians believed in angels, they believed they were deities of a lower order. To the Aztecs, only kings and queens would be carried on the shoulders of another. Our Lady is being brought to the people by an angel to signify a new beginning. The color of her gown is said to be the color of dawn, again signifying the beginning of a new era. While Mary's right foot is planted, symbolizing her standing on the head of the serpent, her left knee is bent. This bent knee symbolizes Mary's action, especially in doing God's will. If you look carefully at both sides of the image, divided by the seam, which is down the middle, there actually is a seam in the tilma, almost down the middle. It actually looks like the left side, as you look at the image, is darker, and that side appears to be more static. The right side, however, appears to be more vibrant. The colors are brighter, and Our Lady's bent knee implies movement. The gold border of her mantle is a sign of nobility. The turquoise color of her mantle is symbolic of heavenly beauty. The 8 pointed stars on her mantle indicate that she comes as the Queen of Heaven. Stars also point to the beginning of a new era, as we know from the Star of Bethlehem. Interestingly, a number of researchers have concluded that the stars on the mantle appear exactly as they would have been in the sky before dawn on the morning of December 12, 1531, which is the date of Our Lady's fourth apparition when she gave Juan Diego a sign for the bishop. The brooch around her neck contains a small cross that was the Christian cross carried by Cortez and the friars, and it symbolizes sanctity. The black sash actually has two meanings. In Aztec culture, young unmarried women wore this sash as a symbol of their virginity. It was removed only when they married. It is therefore a symbol of Mary's virginity. The sash also indicated pregnancy. Thus, Mary is with child. She is bringing Christ to the world. She is indeed the God-bearer. Christ places himself under her protection. Our Lady of Guadalupe then conveys a maternal presence or a divine motherhood. And this is one of the reasons that she is our patroness of the pro-life movement and the patroness of the unborn. If you look closely when you're in front of the image, you will see that the flower pattern on her tunic is not actually a part of the garment because they do not correspond with the folds of the tunic. Now, there's a danger in understanding the image too much and focusing on details. Just a couple weeks ago, I was at our monthly pro-life liturgy. We have one at a parish somewhere in the diocese each month. And there was a statue of Our Lady next to the ambo, and of course I'm looking at it and I'm going, well, for Pete's sakes, those flowers go in the fold. Don't they know that's not really the way they work? So you don't want to focus too much on details, okay? If you have a sculpture, it's very hard to represent the image exactly the way it is in Mexico City. There's a gauze overlay that had symbolic meaning for the Indians. On the overlay, one can see a small, single flower, a jasmine, with four petals directly below the ribbons of the black sash and directly over Mary's womb. You probably can't see it at that distance, but I guarantee you if you come up and look at the image, you will see that one single four-petaled jasmine right here. For the Aztecs, this flower was the flower of the sun or the flute player flower. It's a symbol of new life. It also represented the four corners of the earth and the meeting point of heaven, earth, and the underworld to the Aztecs. The eight-petaled Mexican jasmines, unlike the four-petaled one over her womb, had four smaller outer leaves that protected the flower bud. These flowers symbolized the god Quetzalcoatl from pre-Aztec mythology, who, when he was human, taught peace, harmony, and the possibility of salvation. He was one of their gods who did not demand human sacrifice, as did the other Aztec gods. Then there are triangular heart-shaped flowers, and these are the Mexican magnolia. And there are nine of these flowers symbolizing the nine levels of the Aztec underworld, and the shape of the flowers might have reminded the Aztecs of the human hearts that were sacrificed on the altars. There are six of these flowers below her heart, one on each sleeve and one on her bosom. Well, why then, with Mary's primary mission of evangelizing the Aztecs, is she considered to be the patroness of the unborn and the patroness of the pro-life movement? Human life has always been the focus of the battle between good and evil, or now what we call the culture of life versus the culture of death. From Moloch to the Aztecs of pagan Mexico to Nazi Germany to present-day abortion mills, human sacrifices continue. As one expert on the image writes, everything about Mary of Guadalupe speaks of life. John Paul II, in his homily in Mexico City in 2002, said, "The Guadalupe event meant the beginning of evangelization with a vitality that surpassed all expectations. Christ's message through his mother took up the central elements of the indigenous culture, purified them, and gave them the definitive sense of salvation. Consequently, Guadalupe and Juan Diego have a deep ecclesial and missionary meaning and are a model of perfectly enculturated evangelization." Mary brought a culture of life to the Indians who had lived so long in a culture of death with ritual sacrifice on a scale unsurpassed in history. As I said before, Cortez changed the law on human sacrifices, but Our Lady helped to change the hearts. She can do the same for us if we allow her. Our Lady of Guadalupe made certain nothing was done without the bishop, without authority. She didn't want to divide the Indians and the Spaniards. She wanted to bring them together in the same faith, and this is what we need to do today. There were four important dynamics of the conversion of the culture of death to the culture of life in Mexico. One, Mexico was a totally demoralized and destroyed culture. Secondly, the Mother of God brought life himself to that culture. Three, the church leadership was in union with heaven, and strong, holy, missionary, and Marian. And four, the people had a childlike acceptance of the true faith. Just as with pagan Mexico in the first half of the 16th century, we too have a demoralized culture. There is no longer a sense of absolute truth. Moral relativism has a strong foothold on society worldwide. The sanctity of human life ethic has been replaced with a quality of life ethic. We and our children and grandchildren are bombarded daily with anti-life, anti-chaste messages through the mainstream media. There are an estimated 50 million abortions committed worldwide each year, with 1.3 million right here in the United States. The truth and meaning of human sexuality has been rejected. Large families are no longer seen as the blessings that they are. Just last Tuesday evening, I was watching the news on Fox, and I saw two psychologists who were criticizing a family that was expecting their fifth child, saying there is no way a mother can be emotionally connected to so many children. Large families are no longer valued as they should be. Every child should be welcomed as a blessing, and people need to put a stop to the anti-child comments or thoughts that they have. In addition to being an anti-child attitude, non-marital sex, contraception, cohabitation, abortion, divorce, homosexuality, pornography, and all sorts of perversion are rampant, and there's no sense of shame for immoral behavior. Just as the Aztecs had their pagan gods, these assaults and the individuals and organizations advocating against the dignity of the human person serve as pagan gods for many. Is our church leadership totally in union with heaven? Is it strong, holy, missionary, and Marian? Do we have bishops, priests, and missionaries who, like the first 12 Franciscan missionaries to arrive in Mexico, walked barefoot for 8 days to their destination? Of course we have some. Unfortunately, we also have many who are not, and we need to pray fervently for both groups. And what about the laity? Have they or will they accept the call to conversion? Will they stand for the truth and the meaning of human sexuality? Will they work to get evil sex education removed from the schools? Will married couples abandon contraception and embrace NFP when they have a serious reason to avoid a pregnancy? And will individuals and nations reject abortion as the evil that it is? Or will we succumb, like so many Catholics and other Christians, who view the killing of the preborn as no more important than the economy or recycling? They go about their lives each and every day with no thought for the nearly 4,000 babies killed in their mother's wombs for little or no reason and every day in this country. Make no mistake, I'm a huge animal lover, okay? Daisy rules in our household, all right? But I will never understand how in this country you can go to jail for mistreating an animal, but you can pay to have an abortionist legally kill a baby up to the moment of her birth. Does that make any sense to anybody? We have laws that protect turtle eggs, dolphins, and eagles, but not preborn children. If a woman wears a fur coat, she'll be called a murderer. But if a woman decides to have her baby killed, it will be her choice. We have people fighting for animal rights while advocating the killing of preborn humans. Courts are ordering that feeding tubes are to be pulled from cognitively impaired individuals. And we have newborns being starved to death in the hospital because they are less than perfect. And yet, you will go to jail if you starve your animal. We live in a culture where abortion is a so-called right embraced and promoted by radical feminists and men who fear them. Sadly, the church is infected with radical feminists who, among other dissent, totally reject Humanae Vitae in Evangelium Vitae. They see nothing wrong with contraception or abortion. Even more grievous, some leaders of this movement are religious sisters. I'm sure you've heard of Catholics for a Free Choice. Because they are very upfront about their pro-abortion stance, the USCCB has declared that they are not a Catholic group. The National Coalition of American Nuns is another pro-abortion group calling itself Catholic. About 2 years ago, I came across a photo of Sister Donna Quinn, a longtime member of NCAN and a Sinsinawa sister. Hang on. Fasten your seatbelts. Sister Donna was wearing a sweatshirt that in huge letters said, Nuns for Choice. These are just a few examples right here in Indiana. Tragically, this type of scandalous behavior is becoming widespread throughout the country. We need another Guadalupe event, and we need it now. Yeah. Our Lady is waiting. She wants to help, but do we ask? We know what to do, but do we do it? Juan Diego was faithful and obedient. We can and should take a lesson from him. He didn't think he was qualified, but even so, he was obedient. The bishop was also faithful and obedient. Are we obedient? Do we recognize that courage is not the absence of fear, but acting in spite of our fears? Or, I loved what Father Emmerich said, courage is fear that has said its prayers. I love that. I'm stealing it. When we know the Holy Spirit is leading us to speak against abortion and other assaults on life, do we do it even though we don't think we are qualified? Do we take time to learn how to answer the claims made by the abortion apologists? Do we quit when we think we failed? Do we follow directions like Juan Diego? Do we move forward even when we are afraid? Do we just give up because all of our prayers and efforts seem to change nothing? Or do we keep on keeping on? Are we doing anything to build a culture of life in our sphere of influence? I must admit, it really ticks me off when I learn of individuals who always have an excuse for never getting involved and who will never speak up. While we need to be opposed to all anti-life attitudes and activities, each of us may be called to different areas of service or activity. We must remember that not everyone will be called to activism for the same life issue or to the same activity. And one's focus of involvement may change over the years. We have to pray, but we have to be open to what we believe God would have us do, and then we have to do it. Whether you are a leader or a follower, whether you're gifted or just willing, extremely busy or have lots of time on your hands, we all share a responsibility to do something. Don't put your head in the sand. The killings go on each and every day. Can we stand by? If you have a legitimate excuse, and I know some people do, that's okay. But if you have to search for a reason not to do something, or if your excuses are really pretty flimsy, then maybe you better get back down on your knees. And if you truly don't have time, use your checkbook. Support a pro-life organization. Support your own Respect Life office. There are so many opportunities for service in the pro-life movement. However, never forget, you must take care of your family first. Neglecting your children to engage in pro-life activities is not pro-life. Sit down, figure out how much time per week you could give to pro-life efforts. Maybe it's only 15 minutes. Maybe it's 15 hours. In my case, maybe it's 35. Whatever it is, set it aside, make it a goal, and then do whatever you believe you are called to do. All of us can and must pray. But we need to put those prayers into action. We must do something. It doesn't have to be a major undertaking, unless that's what God is calling us to do. But we simply cannot stand by while the killing continues. As I mentioned previously, I'm still amazed by those who are unwilling to do anything for the pro-life movement. And what really astonishes me is that these same people can always find time for hobbies and social events, television, movies, getting their nails done, getting their hair fixed, going to the spa, and yet they can't even spend 5 minutes a day praying specifically for the end to abortion and the conversion of abortionists. If nothing else, can't we at least stand up for life when we hear others in our sphere of influence defending abortion or other anti-life activities? Can we at least oppose those anti-child comments I mentioned before? We are not necessarily called to do the same thing. I just want to run through a sample of some of the things maybe you've thought about, maybe you haven't thought about, but things that you could do. Praying on a regular basis for an end to abortion and the conversion of abortionists. Pray at an abortion facility on a regular basis. Join a peaceful picket. Learn to sidewalk counsel outside an abortion mill. Serve on your parish Respect Life committee. Sign up for your parish legislative email tree. Write out well-thought letters to the editor. Promote and/or teach NFP. Offer to help the schools with books, or give talks on chastity. Lobby your elected officials. Encourage pro-life doctors. Educate doctors who prescribe contraception or do sterilizations or in vitro fertilization. Promote alternatives to abortion. Volunteer at pregnancy care centers. Distribute pro-life brochures, and you can be very creative in doing that. Fly on an airplane with me. Sit in the seat after me. You'll be educated. Encourage your pastors and your priests to speak out. Help with post-abortion healing programs. If you've had an abortion, share your testimony. Take advantage of blogs or discussion groups. Boycott corporate supporters of Planned Parenthood. And here's one that I find most people don't think of, and I think is one of the most important. If your church has a book club, start your own book club and concentrate on the encyclicals that concern life. Humanae Vitae, Evangelium Vitae, Donum Vitae, Veritatis Splendor. You'd be amazed at how people will actually sign up and will learn from these studies. Well, there are all kinds of things you can do. I said before, I'm not suggesting that every Catholic engage in all these activities or donate 40 hours a week during pro-life work. Some may, but couldn't everyone give at least 1 hour a week? Most of us are not called to do the extraordinary, just the basics. As Mother Teresa said, holiness does not consist in doing extraordinary things. It consists in accepting, with a smile, what Jesus sends us. It consists in accepting and following the will of God. Mary demonstrated that it is possible to transform a culture when she helped lead the Indians away from their pagan gods and leading them to Christ and his church. If only more bishops, priests, religious, and the laity will rise up, we can defeat the culture of death. We need to fervently pray for bishops and for priests and religious and for other laity. We have to do that, and we also have to call them to action. What I have found out with all of the priests that I work with and the ones that I've met throughout the world, the ones that are really willing to do the work are the ones who are the most Marian. Just as Our Lady of Guadalupe stood on the symbol of darkness, we need to stand firm against the evil of abortion and other assaults on human life. And we need to lead people to the culture of life. We need to know the truth, live the truth, and teach the truth. We must go into society with the love and the truth of the church, the whole truth, not just the truth we like or think others will like. There is no doubt that the battle for life is a battle between good and evil. And we must remember, as Romans 12:21 tells us, that we are not only to hate what is evil, but also to overcome evil with good. Let me end with this prayer. From John Paul II's prayer at the end of Evangelium Vitae. O Mary, bright dawn of the new world, mother of the living, to you do we owe, to you do we entrust the cause of life. Look down, O mother, upon the vast numbers of babies not allowed to be born, of the poor whose lives are made difficult, of men and women who are victims of brutal violence, of the elderly and the sick killed by indifference or out of misguided mercy. Grant that all who believe in your Son may proclaim the gospel of life with honesty and love to the people of our time. Obtain for them the grace to accept that gospel as a gift ever new, the joy of celebrating it with gratitude throughout their lives, and the courage to bear witness to it resolutely in order to build, together with all people of goodwill, the civilization of truth and love to the praise and glory of God, the Creator and Lover of life. I hope someday my evangelical friends and all those who should be defending life join us in that prayer and are able to say with conviction, Our Lady of Guadalupe, pray for us.
We hope you've enjoyed this presentation of Human Life International. For more information about HLI's mission, please see our website at www.hli.org. That's www.hli.org. Those listeners who wish to order more copies of this recording or other pro-life materials can call us at 1-800-549-LIFE. That's 1-800-549-LIFE.